The next lesson I want to teach on leader shifting is shifting from directing to connecting. And I call this the communication shift, okay? And I love this lesson too, because I think that if I can help you leader shift in this area, it's going to be pretty amazing how much you're going to grow and how much you're going to develop. So let's talk about this. First of all, this was not a natural shift for me. In fact, of the shifts that I talk about in leader shifts, almost all of them were not natural. And I tell you that because when people think of change and growth and evolution, sometimes they kind of almost think that they're natural. This is kind of the next thing I fall into. A lot of these I didn't fall in. And let me just tell you why this wasn't a natural shift to me, because you see me now and you would see me very much as a connector. But first of all, I grew up in a home that I had a strong, choleric father, very good father. But we never had any doubts what we were supposed to do. I mean, we didn't wake up as children and wonder. My father had a plan for every one of our lives, and he had that plan laid out. And we would sit down and have our family meetings, and we all knew what our chores were, and we know that we had to have all those chores done by Saturday at noon. And so all the expectations were very clear. Everything was very direct. And then you got to understand, I grew up in a theological background where in our theology, we were basically taught that the pastor was the head of the church and the authority of the church. And so basically, you know, you kind of preach those messages, and they really weren't two-way streets. You know what I'm saying? They were kind of like, I'm going to direct you, and here we go, and lay not your hand on God's anointed. We love that verse. You know what I mean? And every time we thought that, you know, we needed to have something passed, we made sure that you didn't lay your hand on God's anointed. And guess who was God's anointed? The pastor. Of course we were. Of course we were. We just loved some of those. You know, we loved some verses we didn't talk about. So I grew up in a theological kind of a direct pathway type of thing. And then, you know, my temperament, I'm a choleric. And again, I've never really kind of tried to figure out, I've never had a day where I said, I've got to kind of figure my life out. I kind of had my life figured out very early. And you know, we used to have a saying, you know, God has a plan for your life. And I would tell my people, God does have a plan for your life. And if you can't figure it out, come to me and I'll give one to you. And so you got to understand, direct, I was pretty good. People kind of followed me and they kind of understood where I was and where I got. But let me talk, this shift became very gradual, but it became very definite. I could still remember in my early 30s reading a book by Florence Littauer called Personality Plus. And this book was all about the four temperaments. And she was a fun writer. She wrote it in such a fun way that it was an entertaining book. But basically, she was helping me understand the different temperaments. And being choleric, I wondered why I didn't have any clue why people would want to be phlegmatic and why they'd be melancholy. When I took the test, I had no melancholy in me. I had no phlegmatic in me. So I always just kind of thought that if you were really going to be successful, you were going to be choleric with a little sanguine mixed in. So, you know, you drove hard and had fun. And if you could drive hard and have fun, life was good. And I'm driving hard and having fun, and where are you, and why aren't you driving hard and having fun, and what do you mean you need to think about it? Okay, have a minute, think about it. Okay, now are we ready to drive hard? So I'm very, very narrow, very narrow. And when I started reading your book, it was just eye-opening me. I thought, oh my, John, you're such an idiot. Look at all the people that are so good and effective, and they don't have your temperament at all. So that kind of jolted me. And then when I got ready to start my first company, I was a pastor, but people were starting to want tapes and resources, and I needed to get a company to handle the resources, which is today the John Maxwell Company. And I remember bringing Bob Beal in as a consultant to help me give directions. And Bob, when he came in, he was going to be out for 2 days with us. And for the first day, all he did was ask questions. And when I said all he did was ask questions, it's very simple. All he did was ask questions. I mean, he asked me 500 questions. In fact, he would ask me a question, so I'd share it with him. And I think we're done with the questions now. I think we'll kind of like move on, and he'd ask me another question. And at the end of the day, I said, Bob, I said, I'm paying you an awful lot of money just to ask questions. And he said to me, John, I got to find you before I can lead you. All right, a little less direct again, okay? It was another step. And then when I watched Pat Summitt at the University of Tennessee take her team in for the halftime and the three questions on the marker board at halftime for the girls was, you know, what did we do right? What did we do wrong? What must we change? And I watched these lady basketball players without any coaches. The coaches huddled off in another room. They went up there, and they were talking about the game. And here's what we did right. Here's what we did wrong. And they're writing down, did right, did wrong. Here's what we have to change. And then I watched Pat Summitt walk in. At the end of that discussion, look at that marker board. Make a couple comments about what they stated and what they said. Sent them out. And it was later, after that night, we had a long dinner. And I asked her about that exercise. And she said, John, when I start off as a coach, I led by assumption. Huge statement. And she said, I was constantly missing my players. I assumed they knew things. And she said, the only way I could find out is instead of assuming they knew something, I had to ask them questions. I had to ask them questions. Again, it gets me from directing to more connecting mindset. And so let me tell you a little known story. And that is, you know, most of the time when I teach and lecture, I do what I'm doing right now. I sit on a bar stool. And I found it to be an incredible way to be conversational in my teaching. But it was purely by accident, because when I started in the beginning, I would stand up and I was very intense. And again, I wanted you to get it. So, I spoke loud and direct. And if I didn't think you got it, it didn't bother me. I just did it again, louder and more direct. And, you know, just, I'm just wanting to make sure you got it. You know, when I'm done, I want them to walk out and say, they got it. They got it. And so I was in a racquetball tournament, and I really pulled the lower right part of my back really bad. So bad that for 2 days I couldn't get out of bed. And then I had to go to Pennsylvania to do a conference, and it was a 2-day conference, and I thought, like, I can't do this. I mean, I can't physically do this. So Margaret went along with me, because, I mean, I couldn't get up myself, couldn't dress myself. So she went with me, and so I told her, I said, I'll come, but you have to have a bar stool for me and a table, so I'll just sit and I'll teach. And that's what I did for 2 days in Allentown, Pennsylvania. I just sat on a bar stool and I taught. So I'm going back to the airport, and I'm thinking, wow, I came in this with a bad back, and I can't believe the energy I have. I've got a lot more energy than what's normal. And all of a sudden it hit me. It's because I wasn't expending my energy standing. That I was relaxed and that it didn't require as much energy. And then all of a sudden it hit me. Not only did I save energy by sitting, but what I did is my teaching became conversational instead of directional. And so this was purely by accident. I'm not smart enough to figure this out. If I wouldn't have pulled my back, I would have never sat down and started teaching. And I'm not telling you to do that at all. I don't think it just fit me. And from that day on to this day, I basically have chosen when I can. There's a few occasions I can, but when I can is to basically sit, because I find that if I sit with you, I connect with you. If I'm standing, it can get a little bit more directional. So what I'm the difference between directing and connecting. Let me compare it for a moment. Directing is kind of authoritative, where connecting is collaborative. It's a different mindset. Do I want to come across as an authority with you, or do I want to come across as a person who wants to collaborate with you? Directing is all talking, whereas connecting is quite a bit of listening. Directing is top down, you know. Connecting is side by side. When you direct people, you enlist them. When you connect with people, you empower them. Direction is more assuming. Connecting is more understanding. Directing gives answers. Connecting asks questions. Okay? Directing's more my agenda. Connecting's more your agenda. When I direct, I'm standing on my ground. When I connect, I'm going to your ground. And this is a great leadership shift to make in your leadership. I think directing is mostly all about me, and I think connecting is a lot more about you. So how do we find common ground? So if we're going to be connecting with people, we got to find common ground with them. That's where it starts. My goal is always to find common ground with you. So how do I do that? What's needed to find common ground? Number one, humility. And when I speak of humility, let me say it in this context. Let people know that you need them. There's something very connecting when you go up to people and say, I need you. Especially when it comes from a leader. And by the way, in the beginning, because I was directional, I was exactly opposite. I never expressed to the people that I needed them. You know what I thought? I thought they needed me. Back then, it wasn't, my name is John and I'm your friend. My name is John and I'm Superman. And I'm just going to fly in and land right among you. And, you know, wow, I'm here and be healed and be whole. And, you know, the whole process and, you know, just kind of make everybody go to a higher level. And that, let me tell you something. That worked until God gave me a bigger dream. Now, here's what happens. When God gives you a dream that is bigger than you, you have two choices. You can either become overwhelmed and give up, and that's a possibility, okay? You can just say, oh my gosh, this is way bigger than me. I got to give up. So the choice is I can either give up or I can get help. One of the two. And when the dream becomes big, all of a sudden, giving up wasn't the option. So I said, I've got to get help. I've got to have people help me. So when somebody comes and tells me that they're a self, you know, the phrase, I'm a self-made man, you know, when everybody tells me they're a self-made man, I always look at them and say, oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, that's so terrible. Oh, it's not the reaction they're expecting. But what I'm saying is if you've made everything yourself, you haven't made much. One is too small of a number to achieve greatness. And so today, when I look at what I see as my dream and my vision, my first response is, I need you. I gotta have people. I've gotta have more people. I just at the first of this week sat down with my key leaders and I cast vision for them for transformation. And in the next few years, I need thousands of transformational trainers. Not hundreds. I mean, I need thousands. You say, how many thousands? I don't know. Maybe 20, 25,000. Transformational trainers. Now, I'm just stopping here for a moment. I'm sowing seed right now into you. I need you. I need you. I need every one of you to say, boy, I'd like to be a part of transformation. I'd like to be a transformational trainer. Now, it's not for me to talk about that right now. I'm just casting the vision. But I just want you to know, for what I want to accomplish, I don't need 10. I don't need 100. I don't need like 500. I need thousands of them. And I happen to believe that God will give them to me. I think thousands will once they see the challenge and once we get the vision out there, and that's, again, that's not for today, but it's going to happen very soon. And I think there's a whole bunch of people say, sign me up. I want to be a transformational trainer, of which if you do that really good, you'll graduate and become a transformational leader. Oh, yeah, we're getting it ready. We're getting ready. You don't even know what it's all about, but are you excited about it? Huh? I mean, would you like... This is just a mundane question for average people, but the right question for people like you. Would you just like to be a part of something a lot bigger than yourself that really changed lives, and made a difference. But to do that, I need help. So there's a sense of humility in this process of making this leader shift. The second thing is if you're going to really connect with people, it's curiosity, number two, and that is consistently asking people questions. The difference between my leadership in my 30s and my leadership now is that I lead by asking questions. I used to lead by directing. Now I lead by asking questions. Again, I try to find them before I can lead them. I wrote a book a few years ago, Good Leaders Ask Great Questions. Wow. Because they do. See, as a young leader, I didn't ask questions. I just gave direction. And the reason I did that is I assumed I knew what was best for you. Now, that's kind of arrogant, and it's quite stupid, but I was young and stupid and arrogant. So other than that, there was no problem. But I just assumed, well, of course you're going to want to do this. And to be honest with you, I valued what I thought more than what other people thought. And I didn't realize the need to find common ground back then. So now I ask questions, and I ask questions because there are expectations we have of ourselves. There are expectations we have of others, and there are expectations that others have of us. And the only way I can find the expectations of others and the expectations others have of me is by asking questions. Because assumption is the mother of all mess ups. You want to mess it up? Just start assuming. And wrong assumptions will create a communication gap. So number three. If you want to go from directing to connecting, number three, it takes effort. In other words, you've got to go out of your way to connect with people. If you're going to go find them on their ground, it takes a lot of energy and effort to do that. See, the connection question is, who moves first? And the answer is, the connector moves first. You don't wait for the other person to come to you. You start going to them immediately. So when somebody tells me, when somebody says, John is lonely at the top, they're not a connector. Now, why is it lonely at the top? Because they didn't take anybody at the top with them. And why are they at the top all alone? You need to get off the top and go down to where the people are and bring them to the top with you. And that takes energy. That takes effort. That takes us leaving our position to go there and find the people and connect with them. So there's a tremendous amount of effort in that process, too. My friend Art Williams says, and I love this effort statement, he said, all you can do is all you can do, but all you can do is enough. So just give it 100%. Just give it 100% in effort. Number four, to connect well, trustworthiness is essential. And to be a trustworthy leader is to be someone that people can count on. Maybe the greatest expression of your leadership, maybe, is when somebody comes and says, I can count on you. To have a leader that you can count on. And trustworthy doesn't mean you're perfect, okay? We got to make sure we got that right. I don't think people want a perfect leader. I think they want an authentic leader. An authentic leader isn't perfect, but an authentic leader admits to the weaknesses and the problems and does their best to fix them. They're very open. They're very transparent. And trustworthiness means that that I can count on you. I can count on you. I think if we think of ourselves as being perfect leaders, if we're honest with ourselves, we disqualify ourselves. I mean, let me take a poll. How many of you are just amazingly perfect? Just check it. Because there might be one. I'd like to kind of meet you and kind of say, can I just rub up against you and see if a little bit of that amazingly perfect comes off? How many of you have probably had some failures in your life and made some pretty big mistakes. Would you relate that? Okay. Now, that shouldn't disqualify you as a leader. If you're authentic and you're willing to grow and learn and change. Isn't that right? I mean, to use a biblical example, Peter denied Christ, cussed, and just was totally, I mean, you talk about losing it. In the very hour that, you know, the Savior needed him, old Pete wasn't to be counted on at all. And remember, he was so arrogant that he told God, when Christ told him somebody's going to die, he said, well, it won't be me. It won't be, it could be him, yeah. It could be, so. Yeah, won't be me. And it was him. But isn't it incredible? Just a few weeks later, he was the guy that preached at Pentecost and literally brought in the early church. Now, he wasn't a perfect leader. But remember that encounter that Christ had with him? Peter, do you love me? Because Jesus understood the grounds of leadership should be based upon the love that you have for him. Not the fact that you do it all right all the time. That kind of leaves hope for all of us, doesn't it, huh? So we don't need to discount ourselves. We just need to be authentic. But that helps us connect with people. And by the way, there's something about humanness that's very connecting. We impress people with our success, but we impact them with our failure. And one of the first things we need to do is close the gap. Close the gap. It's good to lead people if you're a little in front of them. It's no good to lead people if you're a mile in front of them. You got to be close enough that they can see you, talk to you, feel you, touch you, be warmed by you. Does that make sense? Okay. Number five is generosity. Just be a generous person. Be the first to give. Be the first to care. Be the first to connect. Generosity is living outside of yourself. The success of my day is based on the seeds I sow, not the harvest I reap. 98% of the people, the success of their day is by the harvest that they reap. Become a seed sower. Don't worry about the harvest. Can I tell you something? The harvest will take care of itself. Don't worry about the harvest. You just sow seeds every day. My entire life, I've just sowed seeds. What I found is it's become huge in my life. Now I'm reaping this incredible harvest. I'm still just sowing seeds. If you'll just sow seeds all your life, don't worry, your harvest will be pretty big. Number six, if you want to connect with people, listening. The best way to find common ground is by being a listener. I love what Andy Stanley says. He said, leaders who don't listen will eventually be surrounded by people who have nothing to say. Isn't that powerful? They'll eventually be surrounded by people who have nothing to say. And the last connecting link, the last to go from a directing person to a connecting person, the last link is encouragement. Which gives people oxygen for their soul. That's what encouragement is. Just breathe into their soul by lifting them up, by encouraging them, by believing in them. My father is a great encourager. Okay? He'll be in November 15th, he'll be 97. And he's just a great encourager. And I asked him one time, I said, Dad, how do you know people need to be encouraged? He said, oh, son, that's simple. If they're breathing, they need to be encouraged. He said, now, son, if they're not breathing, don't waste your time. But if they're breathing, they need to be encouraged. And he was such a phenomenal example of that, just encouraging people. And I just want you to, when you connect people, let me just do a little survey. How many of you like to be encouraged? We do. We all like to be encouraged. There's something about it. When somebody's encouraged, when you see them coming, it just fills your heart with hope, doesn't it? And aren't there other people, when you see them walk into the room, you say, oh, God, keep them away from me. You know, the closer they get to you, the more they suck life right out of you. Okay? Be an encourager. My daughter, Elizabeth, every year we had a Thanksgiving tradition as she was growing up, and we'd take the wishbone and we'd dry it off, you know, the day. And then in the evening, the last thing kind of we do after the Thanksgiving dinner evening is we'd make a wish, and we'd, and I would always go to that dry wishbone and I'd make sure that I had the fragile side so that when we would do it, she always won. And after about 8 or 9 years of winning every time, she said, Daddy, she said, I always win. I always win. She said, every time we do this, I win. And she said, I always get to tell you what my wish is, but I never hear what your wish is because I win. And she said, I won again today. She said, what's your wish? And I said, oh, baby, my wish is for you to always win. I always want you to win. I always want life to be better for you. I always want to see the best for you. When you do that, when you encourage people, you become a great connector in life.